and grew louder as it grew closer. Beneath it, he could hear the jagged pounding of footfalls clocking along his downstairs hall, and then through his living room, and then battering up the stairs in a goth's stampede. He pushed himself back against his pillow, his face drawing down in a rictus of terror even as his eyes widened to circles in his puffy blackish face, and the sound neared. Not a siren anymore, but a scream, high and ululating, a scream that no human throat could make or sustain. Surely the scream of a banshee or of some black heron, come to take him across the river that separates the land of the living from that of the dead. Now the running footsteps clattered straight toward him along the upstairs hall, boards groaning and creaking and protesting under the weight of those merciless run-down boot heels. And suddenly Kit Bradenton knew who it was, and he shrieked as the door burst inward, and the man in the faded jeans jacket ran in, his murderer's grin flashing on his face like a whirring white circle of knives, his face as jolly as that of a lunatic Santa Claus, carrying a galvanized steel bucket high over his right shoulder.
"Hee-yow!"
"No!" Bradenton screamed, crossing his arms weakly across his face. "No, no!" The bucket tipped forward and the water flew out, all of it seeming to hang suspended for a moment in the yellow lamplight like the largest uncut diamond in the universe. And he saw the dark man's face through it, reflected and refracted into the face of a supremely grinning troll who had just made its way up from hell's darkest shit-impacted bowels to rampage on the earth. Then the water fell on him, so cold that his swelled throat sprang momentarily open again, squeezing blood from its walls in big beads, shocking breath into him and making him kick the covers all the way over the foot of the bed in one convulsive spasm, so that his body would be free to jackknife and sunfish, as bitter cramps from these involuntary struggles whipped through him like greyhounds biting on the run. He screamed. He screamed again, then lay trembling, his feverish body soaked from toe to crown, his head thumping, his eyes bulging. His throat closed to a raw slit, and he began to struggle for breath miserably again. His body began to shake and shiver.
"I knew that'd cool you off," the man he knew as Richard Fry cried cheerily.
He set the bucket down with a clang.
I say, I knew that was gonna do the trick, Kingfish. Thanks are in order, my good man. Thanks from you tended to me. Do you thank me? Can't talk? No? Yet in your heart I know you do.
Yee-ga!
He sprang into the air like Bruce Lee in a Run-Run-Shaw kung fu epic, knees spread, for a moment seeming to hang suspended directly over Kit Bradenton as the water had done, his shadow a blob on the chest of Bradenton's soaked pajamas, and Bradenton screamed weakly. Then one knee came down on either side of his ribcage, and Richard Fry's blue-jeaned groin was the crotch of a fork suspended above his chest by inches, and his face burned down at Bradenton's like a cellar torch in a gothic novel.
"Had to wake you up, man," Fry said. "I didn't want you to boogie off without a chance for us to talk a bit."
"Off me!"
"I'm not on you, man. Come on. I'm just hanging suspended above you, like the great invisible world."
Bradenton, in an agony of fear, could only pant and shake and roll his trapped eyeballs away from that jolly, fuming face.
"We got to talk about ships and seals and sailing wax and whether bees have stings. Also about the papers you're supposed to have for me and the car and the keys to the car. Now all I see in your garage is a Chevy pickup, and I know that's yours, kitty-kitty, so how about it?"
"Hey! Papers. Can't talk,"
he gasped harshly for air. His teeth chittered together like small birds in a tree.
"You better be able to talk," Fry said, and stuck out his thumbs.
They were both double-jointed, as were all his fingers, and he wiggled them back and forth at angles that seemed to deny biology and physics.
"'Cause if you aren't, I'm going to have your baby blues for my keychain, and you're going to have to trot around hell with a C&I dog!"
He jammed his thumbs at Bradenton's eyes, and Bradenton jerked back against the pillow helplessly. You tell me, Fry said, and I'll leave you the right pills. In fact, I'll hold you up so you can swallow them. Make you well, man. Pills to take care of everything. Bradenton, now trembling with fear as much as with cold, forced the words out through his clacking teeth.
Papers. In the name of Randall Flagg. Welsh dresser downstairs. Under the contact paper.
Car? Bradenton tried desperately to think. Had he gotten this man a car? It was so far away, all the flames of delirium were in between, and the delirium seemed to have done something to his thought processes, burned out whole banks of memory. Whole sections of his past were scorched cabinets filled with smoldering wires and blackened relays. Instead of the car this awful man wanted to know about, an image of the first car he'd ever owned drifted up, a 1953 Studebaker with a bullet nose that he had painted pink. Gently, Fry put one hand over Bradenton's mouth and pinched his nostrils shut with the other. Bradenton began to buck beneath him. Furry moans escaped around Fry's hand. Fry took both hands away and said, "Does that help you remember?" Strangely, it did.
"C-c-car,"
he said, and then panted like a dog. The world swirled, steadied, and he was able to go on.
"C-c-car's parked behind the Canoco station, just outside of town, Route 51.
"North or south of town?"
"Yes, sir, I got it. Go on."
"Covered with a tarp. Buick. Registration's on the steering post. Made out Randall Flagg."
He collapsed into panting again, unable to say more or do anything except look at Fry with dumb hope.
"Keys?"
"Floor mat. Under..."
Fry's backside cut off any further words by settling on Bradenton's chest. He settled there the way he might have settled on a comfortable hassock in a friend's apartment, and suddenly Bradenton couldn't even get a small breath. He expelled the last of his tidal breath on a single word.
"Please."
"And thank you," Richard Fry Randall Flagg said with a prim grin. "Say goodnight, Kit."
Unable to speak, Kit Bradenton could only roll his eyes whitely in their puffed sockets.
"Don't think unkindly of me," the dark man said softly, looking down at him. "It's just that we have to hurry now. The carnival is opening early. They're opening all the rides, and the pitch till you win and the wheel of fortune. And it's my lucky night, Kit. I feel that. I feel that very strongly. So we have to hurry."
It was a mile and a half to the Canoco station, and by the time he got there it was 3:15 in the morning. The wind had picked up, whining along the street, and on his way here he had seen the corpses of 3 dead dogs and 1 dead man. The man had been wearing some sort of uniform. Above, the stars shone hard and bright. Sparks struck off the dark skin of the universe. The tarp which covered the Buick had been pegged tautly to the ground, and the wind made the canvas flap. When Flagg pulled the pegs, the tarpaulin went cartwheeling off into the night like a large brown ghost, moving east. The question was, in which direction was he heading? He stood beside the Buick, which was a well-preserved 1975 model. Cars did well out here. There was little moisture, and rust had a hard time starting, scenting the summer night air like a coyote. There was desert perfume on it, the kind you can only smell clearly at night. The Buick stood whole in an automobile mortuary of dismembered parts, Easter Island monoliths in the windy silence. An engine block, an axle looking like some muscle boy's dumbbell, a pile of tires for the wind to make hooting sound effects in, a cracked windshield, more. He thought best in scenes like these. In scenes like these, any man could be Iago. He walked past the Buick and ran his hand across the dented hood of what might once have been a Mustang.
"Hey, little Cobra, don't you know you're gonna shut him down?" he sang softly.
He kicked over a stove-in radiator with one dusty boot and disclosed a nest of jewels, winking back at him with dim fire. Rubies, emeralds, pearls the size of goose eggs, diamonds to rival the stars. Snapped his finger at them. They were gone. Where was he to go? The wind moaned through the shattered wing window of an old Plymouth, and tiny living things rustled inside. Something else rustled behind him. He turned, and it was Kit Bradenton, clad only in absurd yellow underpants, his poet's pot hanging over the waistband like an avalanche held in suspended animation. Bradenton walked toward him over the heaped remains of Detroit rolling iron. A leaf spring pierced through his foot like crucifixion, but the wound was bloodless. Bradenton's navel was a black eye. The dark man snapped his fingers, and Bradenton was gone. He grinned and walked back to the Buick, laid his forehead against the slope of roof on the passenger's side. Time passed. At some length, he straightened, still grinning. He knew. He slipped behind the wheel of the Buick and pumped the gas a couple of times to prime up the carburetor. The motor purred into life, and the needle on the gas gauge swung over to F. He pulled out and drove around the side of the gas station, his headlight beams for a moment catching another pair of emeralds, cat's eyes glistening warily from the tall grass by the Canoco station's ladies' room door. In the cat's mouth was the small limp body of a mouse. At the sight of his grinning, moon-like face peering down at it from the driver's side window, the cat dropped its morsel and ran. Flagg laughed aloud, heartily, the laugh of a man with nothing on his mind but lots of good things. Where the Canoco's tarmac became highway, he turned right and began to run south. Chapter 32. Someone had left the door open between maximum security and the cell block beyond it. The steel-walled length of corridor acted as a natural amplifier, blowing up the steady, monotonous hollering that had been going on all morning to monster size, making it echo and re-echo, until Lloyd Henreid thought that between the cries and the very natural fear that he felt, he would go utterly and completely bugshit.
"Mother!"
the hoarse echoing cry came.
"Mother!"
Lloyd was sitting cross-legged on the floor of his cell. Both of his hands were slimed with blood. He looked like a man who has drawn on a pair of red gloves. The light blue cotton shirt of his prison uniform was smeared with blood because he kept wiping his hands dry on it in order to get a better purchase. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, June 29th. Around 7 this morning, he had noticed that the front right leg of his bunk was loose. And since then he had been trying to unthread the bolts that held it to the floor and to the underside of the bed frame. He was trying to do this with only his fingers for tools, and he had actually gotten 5 of the 6 bolts. As a result, his fingers now looked like a spongy mess of raw hamburger. The 6th bolt was the one that had turned out to be the bitch kitty, but he was beginning to think he might actually get it. Beyond that, he hadn't allowed himself to think. The only way to keep back brute panic was not to think.
"Mother!"
He leaped to his feet, drops of blood from his wounded, throbbing fingers splattering on the floor, and shoved his face out into the corridor as far as he could, eyes bulging furiously, hands gripping the bars.
"Shut up, cock-knocker!" he screamed. "Shut up! You're driving me fucking batshit!"
There was a long pause. Lloyd savored the silence as he had once savored a piping hot quarter pounder with cheese from McDee's. Silence is golden. He had always thought that was a stupid saying, but it sure had its points.
"Mother!"
The voice came drifting up at the steel throat of the holding cells again, as mournful as a foghorn.
"Jesus!" Lloyd muttered. "Holy Jesus!"
"Shut up! Shut up! Shut up, you fucking dimwit!"
"Mother!"
Lloyd turned back to the leg of his bunk and attacked it savagely, wishing again that there was something in the cell to pry with, trying to ignore the throbbing in his fingers and the panic in his mind. He tried to remember exactly when he had seen his lawyer last. Things like that grew hazy very soon in Lloyd's mind, which retained a chronology of past events about as well as a sieve retains water. 3 days ago. Yes, the day after that prick Mathers had socked him in the balls. Two guards had taken him down to the conference room again, and Shockley was still on the door, and Shockley had greeted him, "Why, here's the wise-ass puss bag. What's the story, puss bag? Got anything smart to say?" And then Shockley had opened his mouth and sneezed right into Lloyd's face, spraying him with thick spit. "There's some cold germs for you, puss bag. Everybody else has got one from the warden on down, and I believe in share the wealth. In America, even scummy douchebags like you should be able to catch a cold." Then they had taken him in, and Devons had looked like a man who was trying to conceal some pretty good news lest it should turn out to be bad news after all. The judge who was supposed to hear Lloyd's case was flat on his back with the flu. Two other judges were also ill, either with the flu that was going around or with something else. So the remaining bench warmers were swamped. Maybe they could get a postponement. "Keep your fingers crossed," the lawyer had said. "When would we know?" Lloyd had asked. "Probably not until the last minute," Devons had replied. "I'll let you know, don't worry." But Lloyd hadn't seen him since then, and now, thinking back on it, he remembered that the lawyer had had a runny nose himself and...
"Oh, Jesus!"
He slipped the fingers of his right hand into his mouth and tasted blood. But that friggin' bolt had given a little bit, and that meant he was going to get it for sure. Even the mother shouter down there at the end of the hall could no longer bother him, at least not so badly. He was going to get it. After that, he would just have to wait and see what happened. He sat with his fingers in his mouth, giving them a rest. When that was done, he'd rip his shirt into strips and bandage them.
"Mother?"
"I know what you can do with your mother," Lloyd muttered. That night, after he had talked to Devons for the last time, they had begun taking sick prisoners out, carrying them out, not to put too fine a point on it, because they weren't taking anyone that wasn't already far gone. The man in the cell on Lloyd's right, Trask, had pointed out that most of the guards sounded pretty snotty themselves. "Maybe we can get something out of this," Trask said. "What?" Lloyd had asked. "I don't know," Trask said. He was a skinny man with a long bloodhound face who was in maximum security while awaiting trial on charges of armed robbery and assault with a deadly weapon. "Postponements," he said. "I don't know." Trask had six joints under the thin mattress of his bunk, and he gave four of them to one of the screws who still seemed okay to tell him what was going on outside. The guard said people were leaving Phoenix, bound for any place. There was a lot of sickness, and people were croaking faster than a horse could trot. The government said a vaccine was going to be available soon, but most people seemed to think that was crap. A lot of the radio stations from California were broadcasting really terrible things about martial law, army blockades, homeboys with automatic weapons on the rampage, and rumors of people dying by the tens of thousands. The guard said he wouldn't be surprised to find out that the long-haired com-simp pervos had done it by putting something into the water. The guard said he was feeling fine himself, but he was going to get the Christ out just as soon as his shift was over. He had heard the Army was going to roadblock US-17 and I-10 and US-80 by tomorrow morning, and he was going to load up his wife and kid and all the food he could get his hands on and stay up in the mountains until it all blew over. He had a cabin up there, the guard said, and if anyone tried to get within 30 yards of it, he would put a bullet in his head. The next morning, Trask had a runny nose and said he felt feverish. He had been nearly gibbering with panic, Lloyd remembered, as he sucked his fingers. Trask had yelled at every guard who passed to get him the fuck out before he got really sick or something. The guards never even looked at him, or at any of the other prisoners, who were now as restless as underfed lions in the zoo. That was when Lloyd started to feel scared. Usually, there were as many as 20 different screws on the floor at any given time. So how come he had seen only four or five different faces on the other side of the bars? That day, the 27th, Lloyd had begun eating only half of the meals that were thrust through the bars at him, and saving the other half, precious little, under his bunk mattress. Yesterday, Trask had gone into sudden convulsions. His face had turned as black as the ace of spades, and he had died. Lloyd had looked longingly at Trask's half-eaten lunch, but he had no way to reach it. Yesterday afternoon there had still been a few guards on the floor, but they weren't carrying anyone down to the infirmary anymore, no matter how sick. Maybe they were dying down in the infirmary, too, and the warden decided to stop wasting the effort. No one came to remove Trask's body. Lloyd napped late yesterday afternoon. When he woke, the maximum security corridors were empty. No supper had been served. Now the place really did sound like the Lion House at the zoo. Lloyd wasn't imaginative enough to wonder how much more savage it would have sounded if maximum security had been filled to its capacity. He had no idea how many were still alive and lively enough to yell for their supper, but the echoes made it sound like more. All Lloyd knew for sure was that Trask was gathering flies on his right, and the cell on his left was empty. The former occupant, a young jive-talking black guy who had tried to mug an old lady and had killed her instead, had been taken to the infirmary days back. Across the way he could see two empty cells and the dangling feet of a man who was in for killing his wife and his brother-in-law during a penny pochino game. The pochino killer, as he had been called, had apparently opted out with his belt, or if they had taken that, his own pair of pants. Later that night, after the lights had come on automatically, Lloyd had eaten some of the beans he had saved from 2 days ago. They tasted horrible, but he ate them anyway. He washed them down with water from the toilet bowl and then crawled up in his bunk and clasped his knees against his chest, cursing Poke for getting him into such a mess. It was all Poke's fault. On his own, Lloyd never would have been ambitious to get into more than small-time trouble. Little by little, the roaring for food had quieted down, and Lloyd suspected he wasn't the only one who had been squirreling away some insurance. But he didn't have much. If he had really believed this was going to happen, he would have put away more. There was something in the back of his mind that he didn't want to see. It was as if there was a set of flapping drapes in the back of his mind, with something behind them. You could only see that thing's bony skeletal feet below the hem of the drapes. That's all you wanted to see, because the feet belonged to a nodding, emaciated corpse, and his name was Starvation. "Oh, no," Lloyd said. "Someone's going to come. Sure they are. Just as sure as shit sticks to a blanket." But he kept remembering the rabbit. He couldn't help it. He had won the rabbit and a cage to keep him in at a school raffle. His daddy didn't want him to keep it, but Lloyd had somehow persuaded him that he would take care of it and feed it out of his own allowance. He loved that rabbit, and he did take care of it. At first. The trouble was, things slipped his mind after a while. It had always been that way. And one day, while he was swinging idly in the tire that hung from the sickly maple behind their scraggy little house in Marathon, Pennsylvania, he had suddenly sat bolt upright, thinking of that rabbit. He hadn't thought of his rabbit in, well, in better than 2 weeks. It had just completely slipped his mind. He ran to the little shed tacked onto the barn, and it had been summer just like it was now, and when he stepped into that shed, the bland smell of the rabbit had struck him in the face like a big old roundhouse slap. The fur he had liked so much to stroke was matted and dirty. White maggots crawled busily in the sockets that had once held his rabbit's pretty pink eyes. The rabbit's paws were ragged and bloody. He tried to tell himself that the paws were bloody because it had tried to scratch its way out of the cage, and that was undoubtedly how it had happened, but some sick, dark part of his mind spoke up in a whisper and said that maybe the rabbit, in the final extremity of its hunger, had tried to eat itself. Lloyd had taken the rabbit away, dug a deep hole, and buried it, still in its cage. His father had never asked him about the rabbit, might even have forgotten that his boy had a rabbit. Lloyd was not terribly bright, but he was a mental giant when stacked up against his daddy. But Lloyd had never forgotten. Always plagued by vivid dreams, the death of the rabbit had occasioned a series of terrible nightmares. And now the vision of the rabbit returned as he sat on his bunk with his knees drawn up to his chest, telling himself that someone would come, someone would surely come and let him go free. He didn't have this Captain Tripp's flu. He was just hungry, like his rabbit had been hungry. Just like that. Sometime after midnight he had fallen asleep, and this morning he had begun to work on the leg of his bunk. And now, looking at his bloody fingers, he thought with fresh horror about the paws of that long-ago rabbit, to whom he had meant no harm. By 1 o'clock on the afternoon of June 29th, he had the cot leg free. At the end, the bolt had given with stupid ease, and the leg had clanged to the floor of his cell, and he had just looked at it, wondering what in God's name he had wanted it for in the first place. It was about 3 feet long. He took it to the front of the cell and began to hammer furiously against the blued steel bars.
"Hey!"
he yelled as the clanging bar gave off its deep gong-like notes.
"Hey, I want out! I want to get the fuck out of here, understand? Hey, goddammit, hey!"
He stopped and listened as the echoes faded. For a moment there was total silence, and then from the holding cell block came the rapturous hoarse answer.
"Mother! Down here, Mother! I'm down here!"
"Jesus!" Lloyd cried, and threw the cot leg into the corner. He had struggled for hours, practically destroyed his fingers, just so he could wake that asshole up. He sat on his bunk, lifted the mattress, and took out a piece of rough bread. He debated adding a handful of dates, told himself he should save them, and snatch them up anyway. He ate them one by one, grimacing, saving the bread for last to take that slimy, fruity taste out of his mouth. When he was done with this miserable excuse for a meal, he walked aimlessly to the right side of his cell. He looked down and stifled a cry of revulsion. Trask was sprawled half on his cot and half off it, and his pants legs had pulled up a little. His ankles were bare above the prison slippers they gave you to wear. A large, sleek rat was lunching up on Trask's leg. Its repulsive pink tail was neatly coiled around its gray body. Lloyd walked to the other corner of his own cell and picked up the cot leg. He went back and stood for a moment, wondering if the rat would see him and decide to go off where the company wasn't quite so lively. But the rat's back was to him, and as far as Lloyd could tell, the rat didn't even know he was there. Lloyd measured the distance with his eye and decided the cot leg would reach admirably. "Huh," Lloyd grunted and swung the leg. It squashed the rat against Trask's leg, and Trask fell off his bunk with a stiff thump. The rat lay on its side, dazed, aspirating weakly. There were beads of blood in its whiskers. Its rear legs were moving, as if its ratty little brain was telling it to run somewhere, but along the spinal cord the signals were getting all scrambled up. Lloyd hit it again and killed it. "There you are, you cheap fuck," Lloyd said. He put the cot leg down and wandered back to his bunk. He was hot and scared and felt like crying. He looked back over his shoulder and cried, "How do you like rat hell, you scuzzy little cocksucker?"
"Mother,"
the voice cried happily in answer.
"Mother!"
"Shut up!"
Lloyd screamed.
"I ain't your mother. Your mother's in charge of blowjobs at a whorehouse in asshole Indiana."
"Mother,"
the voice said, now full of weak doubt. Then it fell silent. Lloyd began to weep. As he cried, he rubbed his eyes with his fists like a small boy. He wanted a steak sandwich. He wanted to talk to his lawyer. He wanted to get out of here. At last he lay down on his cot, put one arm over his eyes, and masturbated. It was as good a way of getting to sleep as any. When he woke up again, it was 5 p.m., and maximum security was dead quiet. Blearily, Lloyd got off his cot, which now leaned drunkenly toward the spot where one of its supports had been taken away. He got the cot leg, steeled himself for the cries of "Mother!" and began hammering on the bars like a farm cook calling the hired hands in for a big country supper. Supper. Now there was a word. Had there ever been a finer? Ham steaks and potatoes with red-eye gravy and fresh new peas and milk with Hershey's chocolate syrup to dump in it. And a great big old dish of strawberry ice cream for dessert. No, there had never been a word to match supper.
"Hey, ain't nobody there?"
Lloyd cried, his voice breaking. No answer. Not even a cry of "Mother!" At this point, he might have welcomed it. Even the company of the mad was better than the company of the dead. Lloyd let the cot leg drop with a crash. He stumbled back to his bunk, turned up the mattress, and made inventory. 2 more hunks of bread, 2 more handfuls of dates, a half-gnawed pork chop, 1 piece of bologna. He pulled the slice of bologna in 2 and ate the big half, but that only whetted his appetite, brought it raging up. "No more," he whispered, then gobbled the rest of the pork off the chop bone and called himself names and wept some more. He was going to die in here, just as his rabbit had died in its cage, just as Trask had died in his. Trask. He looked into Trask's cell for a long, thoughtful time, watching the flies circle and land and take off. There was a regular L.A. International Airport for flies right on old Trask's face. At long last, Lloyd got the cot leg, went to the bars, and reached through with it. By standing on tiptoe, he could get just enough length to catch the rat's body and drag it toward his cell. When it was close enough, Lloyd got on his knees and pulled the rat through to his side. He picked it up by the tail and held the dangling body before his eyes for a long time. Then he put it under his mattress where the flies could not get at it, segregating the limp body from what remained of his food stash. He looked fixedly at the rat for a long time before letting the mattress fall back, mercifully hiding it from sight. "Just in case," Lloyd Henry whispered to the silence. "Just in case is all." Then he climbed up on the other end of the bunk, drew his knees up to his chin, and sat still. Chapter 33. At 9:22 by the clock over the sheriff's office doorway, the lights went off. Nick Andros had been reading a paperback he had taken from the rack in the drugstore, a gothic novel about a frightened governess who thought the lonely estate where she was supposed to be teaching the handsome master's sons was haunted. Although he wasn't even halfway through the book, Nick already knew the ghost was really the handsome master's wife, who was probably locked up in the attic and crazy as a loon. When the lights went out, he felt his heart lurch in his chest, and a voice whispered to him from deep in his mind, from the place where the nightmares which now haunted him every time he fell asleep lay in wait. "He's coming for you. He's out there now on the highways of the night, the highways in hiding. The dark man." He dropped the paperback on the desk and went out into the street. The last of the daylight hadn't gone out of the sky yet, but twilight was nearly over. All the street lights were dark. The fluorescents in the drugstore, which had burned night and day, were also gone. The subdued thrum of the junction boxes atop the power poles was also gone. This was something Nick verified by putting his hand on one and feeling nothing but wood. The vibration, which was to him a kind of hearing, had ceased. There were candles in the office supply cabinet, a whole box of them, but the thought of candles did not comfort Nick very much. The fact of the lights going out had hit him very hard, and now he looked to the west, silently begging the light not to desert him and leave him in this dark graveyard. But the light did go. Nick could no longer even pretend there was a little light left in the sky by 9:10, and he went back to the office and fumbled his way to the cabinet where the candles were. He was feeling around on one of the shelves for the right box when the door behind him burst open, and Ray Booth staggered inside, his face black and puffy, his LSU ring still glistening on his finger. He had been laid up in the woods close to town ever since the night of June 22nd, a week ago. By the morning of the 24th, he had been feeling sick, and at last, this evening, hunger and fear for his life had driven him down to town, where he had seen no one at all but the goddamn muty freak who had gotten him into this fix in the first place. The muty had been crossing the town square just as big as Billy Be Damned, walking as if he owned the town where Ray had lived most of his life, the sheriff's pistol holstered at his right hip and secured to his thigh with a gunslinger's tie-down. Maybe he thought he did own the town. Ray suspected he was going to die of whatever had taken everyone else off, but first he was going to show the goddamn freak that he didn't own jack shit. Nick's back was turned, and he had no idea he was no longer alone in Sheriff Baker's office until the hands closed around his neck and locked there. The box he had just picked up fell out of his hands, wax candles breaking and rolling everywhere on the floor. He was half-strangled before he got over his first terror, and he felt sudden certainty that the black creature from his dreams had come to life. Some fiend from the basement of hell was behind him, and had wrapped its scaled claws around his neck as soon as the power had failed. Then, convulsively, instinctively, he put his own hands over the hands that were throttling him and tried to pull them free. Hot breath blew against his right ear, making a wind tunnel there which he could feel but not hear. He caught one clogged and rasping breath before the hands clamped tight again. The two of them swayed in the black like dark dancers. Ray Booth could feel his strength ebbing as the kid struggled. His head was pounding. If he didn't finish the mutie quick, he would never finish him at all. He throttled the scrawny kid's neck with all the force left in his hands. Nick felt the world going away. The pain in his throat, which had been sharp at first, was now numb and far off, almost pleasant. He stamped his booted heel down hard on one of Booth's feet and leaned his weight back against the big man at the same time. Booth was forced back a step. One of his feet came down on a candle. It rolled away under him and he crashed to the floor with Nick back too on top of him. His hands were finally jarred loose. Nick rolled away, breathing in harsh rasps. Everything seemed far off and floating, except for the pain in his throat, which had returned in slow, thudding bursts. He could taste slick blood in the back of his throat. The large, humped shape of whoever it was who had jumped him was lurching to its feet. Nick remembered the gun and clawed for it. It was there, but it wouldn't come free. It was stuck in the holster somehow. He pulled at it mightily, now crazed with panic. It went off. The slug furrowed the side of his leg and embedded itself in the floor. The shape fell on him like dead fate. Nick's breath exploded out of him, and then large white hands were groping at his face, the thumbs gouging at his eyes. Nick saw a purple gleam on one of those hands in the faint moonlight, and his surprised mouth formed the word Booth in the darkness. His right hand continued to pull at the gun. He had barely felt the hot sizzle of pain along the length of his thigh. One of Ray Booth's thumbs jammed into Nick's right eye. Exquisite pain flared and sparkled in his head. He jerked the gun free at last. Booth's thumb, work calloused and hard, turned briskly clock and counterclock, grinding Nick's eyeball. Nick uttered an amorphous scream which was little more than a violent susurrus of air and jammed the gun into Booth's flabby side. He pulled the trigger, and the gun made a muffled whump, which Nick felt as a violent recoil that went nowhere but up his arm. The gun sight had snagged in Booth's shirt. Nick saw a muzzle flash, and a moment later smelled powder and Booth's charring shirt. Ray Booth stiffened, then slumped on top of him. Sobbing with pain and terror, Nick heaved against the weight on top of him, and Booth's body half fell, half slithered off him. Nick crawled out from underneath, one hand clapped over his wounded eye. He lay on the floor for a long time, his throat on fire. His head felt as if giant, merciless calipers had been screwed into his temples. At last he felt around, found a candle, and lit it with the desk lighter. By its weak yellow glow, he could see Ray Booth lying face down on the floor. He looked like a dead whale cast up on a beach. The gun had made a blackened circle on the side of his shirt the size of a flapjack. There was a great deal of blood. Booth's shadow stretched away to the far wall in the candle's uncertain flicker, huge and unshaped. Moaning, Nick stumbled into the small bathroom, his hand still clapped over his eye, and then looked into the mirror. He saw blood seeping out from between his fingers and took his hand away reluctantly. He wasn't sure, but he thought he might now be one-eyed as well as deaf and dumb. He walked back into the office and kicked Ray Booth's limp body. "You fixed me," he told the dead man. "First my teeth and now my eye. Are you happy? You would have taken both eyes if you could have done it, wouldn't you? Taken my eyes and left me deaf, dumb, and blind in a world of the dead. How do you like this, homeboy?" He kicked Booth again, and the feel of his foot sinking into that dead meat made him feel ill. After a little bit, he retreated to the bunk and sat on it and put his head in his hands. Outside, the dark held hard. Outside, all the lights of the world were going out. Chapter 34. For a long time, for days, how many days, who knew, not the trash can man, that was for sure. Donald Merwin Elbert, known to the intimates of his dim and confusing grade school past as the trash can man, had wandered up and down the streets of Poutonville, Indiana, cringing from the voices in his head, dodging away and putting up his hands to shield against stones thrown by ghosts. Hey, trash can. Hey, trash can man, digging your trash. Lit any good fires this week? What did old Lady Semple say when you lit up her pension check trash? Hey, trash baby, wanna buy some kerosene? How'd you like those shock treatments down in Terre Haute, trashy? Trash. Hey, trash can. Sometimes he knew those voices weren't real, but sometimes he would cry out loud for them to stop, only to realize that the only voice was his voice, hitting back at him from the houses and storefronts, bouncing off the cinder block wall of the scrub-a-dubba car wash where he used to work and where he now sat on the morning of June 30th, eating a big sloppy sandwich of peanut butter and jelly and tomatoes and Gulden's Diablo mustard. No voice but his voice, hitting the houses and stores and being turned away like an unwanted guest, and thus returning to his own ears. Because somehow, Poutonville was empty. Everyone was gone. Or were they? They had always said he was crazy, and that's something a crazy man would think, that his hometown was empty except for himself. But his eyes kept returning to the oil tanks on the horizon, huge and white and round, like low clouds. They stood between Poutonville and the road to Gary in Chicago, and he knew what he wanted to do, and that wasn't a dream. It was bad, but not a dream, and he wasn't going to be able to help himself. "Burn your fingers, trash? Hey, trash can man, don't you know playing with fire makes you wet the bed?" Something seemed to whistle past him, and he sobbed and held up his hands, dropping his sandwich into the dust, cringing his cheek into his neck. But there was nothing. There was no one. Beyond the cinder block wall of the scrub-a-dubba car wash, there was only Indiana Highway 130, going to Gary, but first going past the huge, cheery oil company storage tanks. Sobbing a little, he picked up his sandwich, brushed the gray dirt off the white bread as best he could, and began to munch it again. Were they dreams? Once his father had been alive, and the sheriff had cut him down in the street right outside the Methodist church, and he had had to live with that his whole life. "Hey, trash, Sheriff Greeley cut your old man down just like a mad dog, you know that, you fucking weirdo?" His father had been in O'Toole's, and there was some bad talk, and Wendell Elbert had a gun, and he murdered the bartender with it, then went home and murdered Trash Can's two older brothers and his sister with it. Oh, Wendell Elbert was a strange fellow with a badass temper, and he had been getting flaky for a long time before that night. Anyone in Poutonville would tell you so, and they would tell you like father, like son. And he would have murdered Trash Can's mother, too. Only Sally Elbert had fled screaming into the night with 5-year-old Donald, later to be known as the Trash Can Man, in her arms. Wendell Elbert had stood on the front steps, shooting at them as they fled, the bullets whining and striking on the road, and on the last shot the cheap pistol, which Wendell had bought from a nigger in a bar located on Chicago's State Street, had exploded in his hand. The flying shrapnel had erased most of his face. He had gone wandering up the street with blood running in his eyes, screaming and waving the remainder of the cheap pistol in one hand, the barrel mushroomed and split like the remains of a novelty exploding cigar. And just as he got to the Methodist church, Sheriff Greeley pulled up in Poutonville's only squad car and commanded him to stand still and drop the gun. Wendell Elbert pointed the remains of his Saturday night special at the sheriff instead, and Greeley either did not notice that the barrel of the Saturday night special was ruptured, or pretended not to notice, and either way the result was the same. He gave Wendell Elbert both barrels of his over and under. "Hey, trash, you burned your cock off yet?" He looked around for whoever had yelled that. It sounded like Carly Yates or one of the kids who hung out with him. Except Carly wasn't a kid anymore, any more than he was himself. Maybe now he could just be Don Elbert again instead of the Trash Can Man, the way Carly Yates was now just Carl Yates, who sold cars at the stout Chrysler Plymouth dealership here in town. Except that Carl Yates was gone. Everyone was gone. And maybe it was too late for him to be anyone anymore. And he wasn't sitting against the wall of the scrub-a-dubba anymore. He was a mile or more to the northwest of town, walking along 130, and the town of Poutonville was laid out below him like a scale model community on a kid's H.O. railroad table. The tanks were only half a mile away, and he had a toolkit in one hand and a 5-gallon can of gas in the other. Oh, it was so bad, but So after Wendell Elbert was underground, Sally Elbert had gotten a job at the Poutonville Café, and sometime in the first or second grade, her one remaining chick, Donald Merwin Elbert, had started lighting fires in people's trash cans and running away. "Look out, girls, here comes the trash can man. He'll burn up your dresses. Eek, a freak!" It wasn't until he was in the third grade or so that the grown-ups found out who was doing it, and then the sheriff came around, good old Sheriff Greeley, and he guessed that was how the man who cut his father down in front of the Methodist church ended up being his stepfather. "Hey, Carly, got a riddle for you. How can your father kill your father?"
"I don't know, Petey, how?"
"I don't know either, but it helps if you're the trash can man."
"Hee-hee-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha!"
He was standing at the head of the graveled drive now, his shoulders aching from carrying the toolkit and the gas. The sign on the gate read, "Cheery Petroleum Company, Inc. All visitors must check in at the office. Thanks." A few cars were parked in the lot, not many. Many were standing on flats. Trash Can Man walked up the drive and slipped through the gate, which was standing ajar. His eyes, blue and strange, were fixed on the spidery stairs that wound around the nearest tank in a spiral, all the way to the top. There was a chain across the bottom of these stairs, and another sign swung from the chain. This one said, "Keep off. Pumping station closed." He stepped over the chain and started up the stairs. It wasn't right, his mother marrying that Sheriff Greeley. The year he was in the fourth grade, he had started lighting fires in mailboxes. That was the year he burned up old Mrs. Semple's pension check, and he got caught again. Sally Elbert Greeley went into hysterics the one time her new husband mentioned sending the boy to that place down in Terre Haute.
"You think he's crazy? How can a 10-year-old boy be crazy? I think you just want to get rid of him. You got rid of his father, and now you want to get rid of him."
The only other thing Greeley could do was to bring the boy up on charges, and he can't send a kid of 10 to reform school, not unless you want him to come out with a size 11 asshole, not unless you wanted your new wife to divorce you. Up the stairs and up the stairs. His feet made little ringing noises on the steel. He had left the voices down below, and no one could throw a stone this high. The cars in the parking lot looked like twinkling corgi toys. There was only the wind's voice, talking low in his ear and moaning an event somewhere. That, and the far-off call of a bird. Trees and open fields spread out all around, all in shades of green only slightly blued by a dreaming morning haze. He was smiling now, happy, as he followed the steel spiral up and up, around and around. When he got to the tank's flat circular cap, it seemed that he must be standing directly under the roof of the world, and if he reached up, he could scratch blue chalk from the bottom of the sky with his fingernails. He put the gas can and the toolkit down and just looked. From here you could actually see Gary, because the industrial smokes that usually poured from its factory stacks were absent, and the air up that way was as clear as it was down here. Chicago was a dream wrapped in summer haze, and there was a faint blue glint of the far north that was either Lake Michigan or just wishful thinking. The air had a soft golden aroma that made him think of a calm breakfast in a well-lighted kitchen, and soon the day would burn. Leaving the gas where it was, he took the toolkit over to the pumping machinery and began to puzzle it out. He had an intuitive grasp of machinery. He could handle it the way certain idiot savants can multiply and divide seven-digit numbers in their heads. There was nothing thoughtful or cognitive about it. He simply let his eyes wander here and there for a few moments, and then his hands would move with quick, effortless confidence.
"Hey, trash can, why'd you want to burn up a church? Why didn't you burn up the school?"
When he was in the fifth grade, he had started a fire in the living room of a deserted house in the neighboring town of Sedley, and the house burned flat. His stepfather, Sheriff Greeley, put him in the cooler because a gang of kids had beaten him up, and now the grown-ups wanted to start.
"Why, if it hadn't rained, we could have lost half the township thanks to that goddamn firebug kid."
Greeley told Sally that Donald would have to go down to that place in Terre Haute and have the tests. Sally said she would leave him if he did that to her baby, her only chick and child. but Greeley went ahead and got the judge to sign the order, and so the trash can man left Poutonville for a while, for 2 years, and his mother divorced the sheriff, and later that year the voters disowned the sheriff, and Greeley ended up going to Gary to work on an auto assembly line. Sally came to see Trash every week, and always cried. Trash can whispered, "There you are, motherfuck," and then looked around furtively to see if anyone had heard him say that bad swear. Of course no one had, because he was on top of Cheery Oil's number one storage tank, and even if he had been down on the ground, there was no one left, except for ghosts. Above him, fat white clouds floated by. A large pipe projected out of the tangle of pumping machinery, its bore better than 2 feet, its end threaded to take what the oil people called the clutch hose. It was strictly for outflow or overflow, but the tank was now full of unleaded gasoline, and some of it had trickled out, perhaps a pint, cutting shiny tracks through the light fall of dust on the tank. Trash can stood back, eyes bright, still gripping a large wrench in one hand and a hammer in the other. He dropped them, and they clanged. He wouldn't need the gasoline he'd brought after all. He picked up the can, yelled, "Bombs away!" and dropped it over the side. He watched its tumbling, glinting progress with great interest. A third of the way down, it hit the stairs, bounced off, and then fell all the way to the ground, turning over and over, spraying amber gas from the side that had been punched open when it hit the stairs. He turned back to the outflow pipe. He looked at the shiny puddles of gasoline. He took a package of paper matches from his breast pocket and looked at them, guilty and fascinated and excited. There was an ad on the front that said you could get an education in almost anything you wanted at LaSalle Correspondence School in Chicago. "I'm standing on a bomb," he thought. He closed his eyes, trembling in fear and ecstasy, the old cold excitement on him, making his toes and fingers feel numb.
"Hey, Trash, you fucking firebug!"
The place in Terre Haute let him go when he was 13. They didn't know if he was cured or not, but they said he was. They needed his room so they could put some other crazy kid in it for a couple of years. Trashcan went home. He was way behind in his schoolwork now, and he couldn't seem to catch the hang of it. They had given him shock treatments in Terre Haute, and when he got back to Poutonville, he couldn't remember things. He would study for a test and then forget half the stuff and flunk with a 60 or 40 or something like that. For a while he didn't light any fires, though. There was that, at least. Everything had gone back to the way it should be, it seemed. The father-killing sheriff was gone. He was up there in Gary putting headlights on Dodges, putting wheels on miscarriages, his mother sometimes said. His mother was back working in the Poutonville Cafe. It was all right. Of course there was Cheery Oil, the white tanks rising on the horizon like oversized whitewashed tin cans, and behind them the industrial smokes from Gary, where the father-killing sheriff was, as if Gary was already on fire. He often wondered how the Cheery Oil tanks would go up. 3 single explosions, loud enough to rip your eardrums to tatters and bright enough to fry your eyeballs in their sockets? 3 pillars of fire, father, son, and holy father-killing sheriff, that would burn day and night for months? Or would they maybe not burn at all? He would find out. The soft summer breeze puffed out the first 2 matches he lit, and he dropped their blackened stumps onto the riveted steel. Off to his right, near the knee-high railing that circled the edge of the tank, he saw a bug struggling weakly in a puddle of gasoline. "I'm like that bug," he thought resentfully, and wondered what kind of a world it was where God would not only let you be caught in a big sticky mess like a bug in a puddle of gas, but leave you there alive and struggling for hours, maybe days, or in his case, for years. It was a world that deserved to burn, that was what. He stood, head bowed, a 3rd match ready to strike when the breeze died. For a while when he came back he was called Loony and Halfwit and Torchy, but Carly Yates, who was by then 3 grades ahead, remembered the trash cans, and it was Carly's name that stuck. When he turned 16, he left school with his mother's permission. "What do you expect? They ruined him down there in Terre Haute. I'd sue him if I had the money. Shock treatments, they call it. Goddamned electric chair, I call it. And went to work at the scrub-a-dub-a car wash. Soaped the headlights, soaped the rocker panels, knocked the wipers, wiped the mirrors. Hey, mister, you want hot wax with that? And for a little while longer, things went their appointed course. People would yell at him from street corners or passing cars, would want to know what old Lady Semple, now 4 years in her grave, had said when he lit up her pension check, or if he had wet the bed after he torched that house over in Sedley. And they'd catcall to each other as they lounged in front of the candy store or leaned in the doorway of O'Toole's. They'd holler to each other to hide their matches or butt their smokes because the trash can man was on his way. The voices all became phantom voices, but the rocks were impossible to ignore when they came whizzing from the mouths of dark alleys or from the other side of the street. Once someone had pegged a half-full can of beer at him from a passing car, and the beer can had struck him on the forehead and had driven him to his knees. That was life, the voices, the occasional flying rock, the scrub-a-dubba. And on his lunch break he would sit where he had been sitting today, eating the BLT his mother had made for him, looking at the cheery oil tanks and wondering which way it would be. That was life, anyway, until one night he found himself in the vestibule of the Methodist church with a 5-gallon can of gasoline, splashing it everywhere, especially on the heaps of old hymnals in the corner. And he had stopped and thought, this is bad, and maybe worse than that, it's stupid. They'll know who did it. They'd know who did it even if someone else did it, and they'll put you away. He thought about it, and smelled the gas while the voices fluttered and circled in his head like bats in a haunted belfry. Then a slow smile came to his face, and he had upended the gas can, and he had run straight up the center aisle with it, the gas spraying out. All the way from the vestibule to the altar he had run, like a groom late to his own wedding, and so eager that he had begun to spray hot fluid more properly meant for his soon-to-be marriage bed. Then he had run back to the vestibule, pulled a single wooden match from his breast pocket, scratched it on the zipper of his jeans, flung the match on the pile of dripping hymnals, direct hit, kafloomp. And the next day he was riding to the Northern Indiana Correctional Center for Boys, past the black and smoldering ribs of the Methodist Church. And there was Carly Yates leaning against the light standard across from the scrub-a-dubba, a lucky strike pasted in the corner of his mouth, and Carly had yelled his valedictory, his epitaph, his hail and farewell. "Hey, trash can! Why'd you want to burn up a church? Why didn't you burn up the school?" He was 17 when he went to the jail for kids, and when he turned 18 they sent him over to the state prison, and how long was he there? Who knew? Not the trash can man, that was for sure. No one in Stir cared that he had burned the Methodist church down. There were people in Stir who had done much worse. Murder, rape, breaking open the heads of old lady librarians. Some of the inmates wanted to do something to him, and some of them wanted him to do something to them. He didn't mind. It happened after the lights were out. One man with a bald head had said he loved him. "I love you, Donald." And that was sure better than dodging rocks. Sometimes he would think, just as long as I can stay in here forever. But sometimes at night he would dream of cheery oil, and in the dreams it was always a single thundering explosion followed by two others, and the sound was wham, wham, wham. Huge, toneless explosions slamming their way into bright daylight, shaping the daylight like the blows of a hammer shaping thin copper. And everyone in town would stop what they were doing and look north, toward Gary, toward where the three tanks stood against the sky like oversized whitewashed tin cans. Carly Yates would be trying to sell a 2-year-old Plymouth to a young couple with a baby, and he would stop in mid-spiel and look. The idlers in O'Toole's and in the candy store would crowd outside, leaving their beers and chocolate malteds behind. In the cafe, his mother would pause in front of the cash register. The new boy at the scrub-a-dubba would straighten from the headlights he had been soaping, the sponge gloves still on his hand, looking north as that huge and portentous sound sledge-hammered its way into the thin copper routine of the day. Wham! That was his dream. He became a trustee somewhere along the line, and when the strange sickness came, they sent him to the infirmary, and some days ago there had been no more sick people because all of those who had been sick were now dead. Everybody was dead or had run off, except for a young guard named